It's Wednesday, July 11th, 2018, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. After long time, feels like a couple months. It's good to be back here with you. And as you can imagine, there's a lot for us to talk about today, including Friday night's apology from KMIZ for some decisions that two staffers made in their coverage of last Wednesday night's so-called fireworks war. Also, how a doctored video has led to dozens of deaths in India, and why the government is asking the folks at Facebook's messaging app, WhatsApp, to be more proactive in stopping its viral spread. And the president's choice of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to fill Justice Kennedy's spot on the Supreme Court, it stayed under wraps until just a few minutes before the formal announcement on Monday. Unusual not to have it leaked hours or days ahead of time. We'll talk about how that happened. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our time's up today, but we're going to start with the NATO summit now underway in Brussels. The headline in yesterday's Der Spiegel newspaper summed it up perfectly. Europe was setting up for a Trumper tantrum. And this morning at breakfast, leaders got one.
I think that these countries have to step it up, not over a 10-year period, they have to step it up immediately.
President Trump blasting America's top allies over defense spending at a breakfast kicking off this week's crucial NATO summit.
No other president brought it up like I bring it up. So something has to be done.
The president directing the brunt of his criticism at Germany, complaining that the U.S. is expected to defend Europe from Russia despite Germany paying Russia billions for energy.
Germany is totally controlled by Russia because they will be getting from 60% to 70% of their energy from Russia and a new pipeline. And you tell me if that's appropriate, because I think it's not. But Germany, as far as I'm concerned, is captive to Russia.
He went on and on, like for minutes, uninterrupted, casting stones at the Germans' relationships to Russia. And the scene around the table was visibly uncomfortable, though I guess decorum called for everyone to just sit and listen without too much reaction. The reaction came later, though, with this warning from European Council President Donald Tusk.
Dear America, appreciate your allies. After all, you don't have that many. And dear Europe, spend more on your defense, because everyone respects an ally that is well prepared and equipped. Money is important, but genuine solidarity is even more important.
So that was a bit of a challenge there. Dear America, appreciate your allies. You don't have that many. And it's kind of got a point. It feels like they're becoming fewer and fewer, especially after what happened at the G8.
Oh, I think that was almost, that was just a single example of him exaggerating about as much as our president exaggerates. Okay. We have lots of allies. NATO may be on shaky ground in terms of how it's going to be paid for or whatever, but at the moment, we still have those alliances. The issue is not that this is an American president who thinks differently about what Europe's contributions should be to NATO. It's how he goes about saying it that's different. And so the so-called tantrum you talk about. But this is exactly how he campaigned. And the one thing I think we've learned about President Trump in the media anyway is that when he's governing the same way that he campaigned. And this is just par for the course.
No, I think you're absolutely right, Mike. I mean, it's all, you know, the media was anticipating that something like this was going to happen when he went to the NATO summit. They're anticipating even more to happen when he arrives in Great Britain, because the UK is sort of waiting in anticipation to trounce on Trump at every sort of even mediocre thing that he says.
Mm-hmm. Just our domestic press, the international press as well.
Yeah, talking about the international press, the British press, the you know, our own press. Mm-hmm. They're waiting to just to hear what he's going to say. And then he's got the meeting with Putin, and there's this expectation that there's going to be a sort of a party or a coming together, a bromance, or you call it what you will. You know, there's that anticipation mm-hmm. happening. So, I mean, it's going to be Trump 24/7, you know, for the next week of what is he going to say, what is he going to do while he's on the international stage. And I go back to what we've talked about before, you know, shiny bauble over here, what's happening over here? So he's over there and the media's there. Meanwhile, as we're going to talk about mm-hmm. in a minute, the nomination, the Supreme Court nomination, and that battle is happening underneath what's going to happen there.
As are extensions going on, looking for the immigrant detainee children.
Yes.
That battle playing out in the court. There are a lot of other things that are starting to lose the attention as it does focus overseas.
But I will say that in addition to this being classic President Trump with the shiny bauble over here, I believe with NATO, he actually believes
what he is saying.
He doesn't think that we should be paying as much as we are and that Europe should be paying more. He doesn't care that there's this world order for the past 60 years. It's protected democracy and the global economy. He doesn't really care, and he's made it clear lots of times.
Well, I mean, I read an interesting article this weekend that talks about he's basically saying in his Trump-like way what Obama has said, what Clinton has said, what George W. Bush said, is that, look, you know, Europe, you've got to pay more money for the defense. We can't continue to do this while we're also dealing with what's going on in the Middle East, what's going on in Southeast Asia, what's happening on the Korean Peninsula. You know, we can't continue to do this. But the way in which he says it and how blunt he is about it is, I think, what's really stirring the pot here.
Okay, well, before leaving for Brussels, the president had some business to attend to here at home, the naming of his new Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. Going into Monday night's primetime announcement, there was lots of secrecy, more than it seems like we've seen in some of the more recent nominations to the court. Here's how the news broke on MSNBC only 7 minutes before the event in the White House.
I'm going to go back just momentarily to Pete Williams, who I think has some news about who this choice is likely to be.
So we're told now, NBC News is reporting that the president will nominate Brett Kavanaugh to succeed Anthony Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court. He's the person we were just talking to. Here it is, just a little shy of 8 minutes before the president was to speak. So this thing did hold pretty well.
I don't know, maybe my memory is failing me, but didn't it seem for so many of these other announcements, maybe in the last decade or so, that there was no real drama? We already knew who it was that the president was about to unveil or introduce. When you talked about Gorsuch, when you talked about Alito, when you talked about Roberts, even Sotomayor and Kagan, you knew.
Yeah, I think that there was some secrecy around this, but I also think a lot of it revolves around the fact that there was a list. And he said it was going to come from this list. It was a list that was generated by the Federalist Society and others while he was campaigning for president. Mm-hmm. So I think everyone sort of focused on that list, but they seemed to be focusing so much on the hard social conservatives who were on that list, as opposed to any of the sort of, I won't say, you know, middle of the road moderates, but not as staunchly as some of the others. And that may be the fact that the media was focusing so much on them and not focusing on these others, to where this thing was able to be so secretive up to that point.
You know, I will say that it's interesting too that the network with Pete Williams, who got the slight jump on this story, also didn't do themselves a favor with another story they thought they got a jump on. So they had one of their Capitol Hill reporters, Leanne Caldwell, who tweeted out this story that basically President Trump had met with Anthony Kennedy, and that was the concession that he extracted from the president. Kennedy said, "I'll retire because you're going to choose Kavanaugh," and then she had to pull that.
Who had clerked for him, that was their connection. It was kind of a win that wasn't so much a win. It was a win with a bruise on it.
Well, so they put it out there, and one of their reporters also carried the story. But then it turned out that she had to retract that tweet because one source. How many times do we get in trouble
for one source
told us this? Turned out we couldn't confirm it.
Right. And you know, to me, it's one of those things where you're trying to, the media, news media, they're trying their best to try to figure out who is he going to pick so that they can one up the other network. It's that sort of thing. Instead of, let's fully try to vet the people we know who are on the list. If he's saying,
instead of sending people to South Bend or to the hometowns to figure out and peeking in windows who's home and who's not.
Right. That's, to me, trying to get to that instead of, let's vet the ones that we know are on the list. I mean, here's a president who's basically given you a list. Mm-hmm. Other presidents have given you no list whatsoever, and you're definitely trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he gave you more information than previous presidents have given you.
You know, there was one other story, media angle to this story that I found was really interesting, and a lot of major news organizations picked up on that right before the announcement was made, about a week or so ago, talking about how there were serious efforts to discuss packing the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Something that I didn't really know going back, but historically, Congress, I think 7 or 8 times, you know, in the U.S. history, has changed the number of Supreme Court justices, mm-hmm. and now there are folks saying, well, maybe if the Democrats were to get control of Congress and the White House in 2020, they should pack the Supreme Court to dilute the influence of these conservatives.
Well, I mean, the most infamous time was when FDR tried to pack the court back in the 1930s to basically enact many of his New Deal policies to make sure that they wouldn't be overturned by the courts, and that didn't play out very well because even his own party said, whoa, wait a minute, we don't want to do that. And so I think that this was one of those stories that was, I would say, probably put out there by sort of influential Democratic operatives who wanted to say, hey, you know we can't stop this, but maybe we can do this.
But watch out what you wish for, right? Because look what's happened in Venezuela, Poland, in Hungary, with presidents stacking the courts. I mean, maybe you would consider something like term limits for judges. That's another thing that's been discussed. People who know they can't stop or don't think they can stop this nomination. But to pack the court, I don't think in this day and age that's going to be helpful.
Right. I think there's one other thing, and there are very few stories on this that I thought really should have come out was the fact that, you know, when a Supreme Court nominee is picked and what they say and what they may have done in the past doesn't necessarily mean that this is the way they're going to act in the future. I mean, When Sandra Day O'Connor was picked to go on the court, there was this strong belief that she was going to be this very conservative justice, and that didn't play out over the course of her time in on the court. So, I mean, you just don't know, because right now you have Kavanaugh, but that doesn't mean that one of the others who are on the Supreme Court
may not necessarily move a little
exactly,
bit left.
Exactly.
Okay, so here's something that some might consider a gutsy move. There's a tradition in journalism: we protect our sources. When situations warrant it, we use anonymous sources and keep their anonymity no matter what. And sometimes that might mean a judge might hold a journalist in contempt and throw them in jail. The biggest name reporter people probably remember who did jail time to protect a source was Judith Miller, when she refused to name the person who identified CIA operative Valerie Plame. Well, enter well-known national security blogger Marcy Wheeler. She didn't just reveal one of her sources, she literally handed them over to the FBI and has now ended up serving as a witness in a case. She wrote about her decisions on her blog, but basically, she is saying, and she has told Margaret Sullivan from the Washington Post, her conscience drove her to act. She knew about something that was about to happen, and she couldn't stay quiet about it.
And it's really hard to know, because Marcy Wheeler's been very careful about how much of this story to reveal.
Yeah, because it's still happening.
But basically, she said she had a source who she believed was responsible, you know, for helping the Russians in tampering with our election. She believed that this source was lying to her. She believed that this source was involved in cyber attacks that were harming innocent individuals. And it must be said, she's come to believe that Trump associates did collude with the Russians. And so for all those reasons, she said she was going to go to the FBI and reveal her source.
And I think one of the other reasons was she was afraid that this source was going to continue to do those things and not only put others, innocents in danger, but maybe even herself. She sort of alluded to that a little bit because of what's been going on in terms of when the Russians, you know, get upset with someone, bad things happen.
See what's happened in Britain and with some of the nerve gas attacks.
Exactly. So I think that's part of what's going on here.
So let me ask you this. She said that in consulting with attorneys and a couple of other things in making this decision, she started to look at herself kind of as a member of the clergy who might hear a confession and be like, if something has already happened, they can grant absolution. But if there's a crime that is in progress, that there's an obligation to report that to authorities. Is it breaking that social contract journalists have with sources and with the public, do you think? Did she do that?
I think in some ways, yes. But I also think that one of the things that we as journalists tend to forget is that we're also human beings, mm-hmm. and we do have a conscience. Mm-hmm. And sometimes what we feel individually and in our soul bumps up against our journalistic morals. And sometimes, though, your own conscience and what you believe in morally trumps the journalistic morals.
And assuming that that is what happened, and I have no reason to doubt it at all, then I would agree that sometimes you have to say, I'm going to be a human being first and a journalist second. One thing that is interesting, though, because she is a very well-respected writer in this subject, but she has no editor. She's her own editor.
Exactly.
And so she had no one to bounce this off of, except maybe some attorney she said she contacted. Mm-hmm. I think that makes it more difficult to make that decision and make it correctly, but I have no reason to doubt that she was right in what she did.
Yeah. Okay, well, for the last 2 weeks, the world, in fact, some of the gentlemen at the table with me, has been gripped by the World Cup, by other big world stories, including that soccer team that has now safely been rescued from inside the cave in Thailand. Ask almost anyone about it, and you're gonna see folks talking about those two global stories. They've been captivated. But there's another story halfway around the world that we're not nearly as focused on, and maybe we should be. The deadly ongoing riots in India, which have all been tied to a viral video spreading rapidly via the messaging application WhatsApp. This video comes from a report on, that we're about to play, comes from a report on that video's origins as put together by the BBC.
Two men on a motorbike apparently snatch a young child off the street in a video that has spread a dangerous panic in India.
In fact, this footage was filmed in this street in Karachi, Pakistan, not in India. And the full video makes clear this was not a real kidnapping, but an advert designed to promote child safety.
The version spread on social media has this ending edited out.
And at the end there, you see that there is a sign and it says it only takes a minute to kidnap a child from the streets of Karachi. We've been talking about the spread of misinformation on social media for months, for years. This feels different though, because it's been on a one-to-one messaging app. It takes a very different level of virality when you're communicating one-on-one versus one to few or one to many.
But when you look at WhatsApp in India especially, mm-hmm. there are hundreds of millions of people who use that app. It's the biggest market in the world for WhatsApp. So there's an awful lot of people to be spreading it person to person to person. The other thing about WhatsApp that's really, you know, interesting, of course, and relevant is that it's an encrypted app. And it's mm-hmm. why you have journalists and, you know, human rights activists and dissidents in other countries use it, because it is encrypted. You can't tell from either end who sent the message unless you have the key to get it. So is that a good or a bad thing? It depends on the circumstance. The Indian government says, well, you need to help us to stop this by taking these down. But it's
then
not
WhatsApp says it's not that easy.
It's not that easy.
Right.
It's doable, but it is not that easy without violating a central tenet of WhatsApp that in other contexts is useful.
You know, I think one of the main issues here is, and it goes back to what you were just saying, is that this one-to-one, because I use WhatsApp, mm-hmm. and only the people who are on the thread that I'm using are on the chain that I'm using. They're the only ones that get the information.
Have access to it
and that sort of thing. But to me, it does boil down to some things you can't legislate, mm-hmm. and some things you just can't control. The use of technology can't always be controlled by, say, a governmental entity or an institution. Sometimes people, individuals, have to take responsibility for what they're consuming and what they're sending.
Well, and that there's another lesson that comes into play there, in the sense that this video has been edited, taken out of context to begin with, and then edited to take it out of context even further, that as content creators and publishers, we really do lose control of whatever we're putting out there second we publish it.
Oh, yeah.
It's true. And it does appear that WhatsApp was used in these particular instances of mob violence. But there's been mob violence in India for years, and there are a lot of societal problems in terms of not enough police, ill-trained or corrupt police officers, a court system that's so bogged down it can't deal with cases. And so you have people taking mob violence or action, believing that, you know, they have to be the law in order to get justice. There's also religious tensions in India,
and
the Modi government, for example, and caste issues that lead to this sort of division that make it very easy for these sort of mobs to get inside.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you go back to a lot of the conversations that we've had over the course of the last couple of years, it revolves around, are people taking control of the information that they're getting in and saying, wait a minute, let me stop for a second and check another source. It's almost like we see something on either on our social media platform or say WhatsApp or whatever, and we immediately believe it instead of questioning it. And that's the, I think that's the thing that really concerns me as an educator, is that our lack of critical thinking and the ability just to stop and say, wait a minute, is what I'm seeing, is what I'm reading, is what I'm viewing, you know, is this true?
What's provenance of it?
Yes.
And where did it come from?
Yes.
Okay, I want to go back for a second to the Trumps. This one isn't political, though. One by one, we're hearing about the different ways the Trumps are working their angles and keeping support for their business interests, like the six-figure dollar amounts that Ivanka Trump, or not Ivanka, I'm sorry, Melania Trump, has been pulling in from the photo agency Getty for the licensure of photos to be used of her in all positive stories. Now, NBC broke this head scratcher last week, and I wanted to make sure that I asked you about this because it is getting a little bit moldy in terms of when this first came out. But this deal with Getty has meant that lots of news organizations have been unknowingly paying the First Lady royalties on photos if they're published. And if I were a subscriber to the Getty Photo Wire, and I found out after the fact that my subscriber fees, as I'm downloading photos to put into my publication, file photos, are going to pay her royalties, I'd be pretty angry.
So there's two aspects of this to me. One is the royalties business. And from everything we can tell, you couldn't know that that agreement existed.
Right.
So
right.
News organizations
there's the transparency issue.
But on the other hand, in the agreement that news organizations had to sign to take these photos and use them, it did say that these could only be used for positive coverage. And so you've got some news organizations now going back and saying, well, I didn't really realize that it said that. They should have known. That was an ethical problem.
No, I agree. I think they should have known that. And the question that I had was, okay, was this agreement made prior to her becoming First Lady or after she became First Lady? I mean, there are a whole bunch of legal issues that should have been worked out by the news organizations and Getty before we got into the area that we're in right now. I mean, it's immediately after the election, there should have been some conversations about, okay, now she's in an entirely different arena. What is your obligation to her? What is our obligation to her? How are our fees that we pay you are going to be used? All that should have been handled immediately after she became First Lady.
And these photos were all taken by one photographer. Yes. So the solution is pretty simple. News
Don't
organizations
use
can find other places to get their photos.
And
what I was going to say is, when I put together the links blog for the show yesterday, I made sure any photos were from the White House. They were whitehouse.gov, and they were all technically public records. Okay, I know that there are some folks in our local audience who've been wanting to hear our take on this. Last week, if you were watching the local news here in the Columbia Jefferson City market, there was no escaping the coverage of the so-called fireworks war just north of the city. Well, Friday evening, KMIZ walked back a bit of its coverage with this apology delivered by anchor Joey Parker.
KMIZ would like to address and take full responsibility for the conduct taken by two of our newsroom employees. The ABC 17 news crew was assigned to cover Columbia's so-called fireworks war Wednesday night when they encountered three people intending to take part in the annual event. Our crew agreed to drive them in exchange for confirmation that Demerit Drive was the location of this year's event. The decision was wrong and failed to live up to the ethical standards KMIZ has set for its journalists. We would like to apologize to the Demerit Drive neighbors, Boone County Sheriff's Department, the Columbia Police Department, and the three young men that were allowed in our vehicle. Our job as journalists is to objectively cover the news, not become participants in the coverage.
So that pretty much summed it up. And the two employees were suspended based on that decision. They have since returned to work, but they did end up becoming part of the story by driving would-be participants. Had there not actually been a fireworks war, would they have been the ones to start it? KMIZ could have been very directly involved in changing the outcome of that story and that decision.
Yes, they could have. Full disclosure, as a young child, we it wasn't anything planned. We basically, had fireworks and shot them at each other and that sort of thing. But a planned event.
That's a great disclosure there.
Yeah, that's a little different. But speaking of what the reporters did here, yeah. If they didn't know where it was, they could have, basically said, hey, tell us where it is. No, we can't take you. I mean, mm-hmm. that's what they should have done. But, when you start looking at it, you go like, okay, you're headed in the same direction as we are. Hop on in. We're going to go. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. Hold on a second.
There are problems there. What happens if somebody gets hurt? What happens?
Oh, yeah. There's so many things that go in your head, yeah. But you're trying to get the story.
Right.
And trying to get the story in the heat of the moment with the deadline, you're sort of thinking, but this is the easiest way to do it.
And KMIZ did the right thing in owning up to this. Yeah, but definitely. Before the event happened, neither KMIZ or for that matter KOMU did a very good job of treating this as a feature story instead of a serious story of public safety.
I got to ask you, I've lived here now 8 years. Mike, you mentioned to me the other day you've been here more than 30. Ernest, on and off again, decades.
20 years.
Have you ever seen coverage of this fireworks war the way we did this year? Why all of a sudden this year did this become a thing?
That's a good question. I have no idea because I've been here for a while. I've been around for a lot of 4th of July's and I've never seen any coverage like this. Not on this particular issue, but according to the sources that were presented both in the Missourian as well as on all three of the stations.
The Missourian, KOMU, KRCG
ended
up picking it up.
This has been going on for
decades.
But yeah. The Missourian story, by the way, at least after the fact, was very responsible. The TV coverage I saw was the anchors were kind of smiling as they're going into it, and it was this big feature about, hey, look at this funny thing that's happening in Columbia.
Yeah, and I mean, you saw images of people getting hit with fireworks, and you kind of go, whoa, wait a minute, it sort of took me back to when I was younger going like, oh, what I did when I was younger was crazy. If this is what I was doing, and so the health hazard or the property damage and all the things that could have happened weren't addressed in any of those stories that you saw on television. They did talk about those in the Missouri.
We are almost out of time, but I got to ask you, remember this, Diddy? Under the New Media. It's Green Day's 2004 hit, American Idiot, and since the opening of a musical of the same name in London and President Trump's upcoming visit to Britain, it's a chart topper again. What happens when the old becomes new? Well, newspapers suddenly write trend stories and sometimes fall for the great archival stuff that's floating around on the web, like yesterday when the Washington Post quoted a piece from the satire website Clickhole that said the song was about George W. Bush. You want to talk about not knowing your sources of news?
Yeah, not knowing your history.
Not knowing your history. And I then spent so much time humming that song. Well, thank you for joining us this week. It has been a very quick half hour. I'd like to thank Mike and Ernest for getting everything in today. And also to Travis McMillan, Tim Pilcher, Aaron Hay. Join us again next week for another edition of Views of the News.